Richard, you've made a good argument for heading for Beach City, certainly as opposed to heading up to Canton. But what's the real gain of putting this airplane on the ground at an airport, in your opinion? Because I think we'll agree its main function right now is to transport you and your passenger from the air to the ground without anyone getting hurt. We don't know why it's shaking. We know it's shaking a lot. It's outside of the pilot's experience. In worst case, it could start shedding parts, right? It's a fixed pitch prop, so that's not going to come apart. But if the motor mounts break and the engine displaces, you could go so far out of CG that the airplane is uncontrollable. Why is it worth the risk?
Yeah, you could. There's a lot of ifs in your statement there, Jeff. Yes, the engine could completely come apart, but right now it's just running extremely rough, and I've got altitude and airspeed and an engine that's producing thrust. And so I can head to an airfield that is much easier to land on. Why? Because people land there every day. It's a grass strip. Mm-hmm. Than a field below me, which is unknown. You know, a good friend of mine, Mike Vivian, likes to say, if you look below at a field below you, if it looks rough, it is. If it looks smooth, it might be, mm-hmm. right? And so landing on a field is a much more difficult proposition than landing on a grass strip. So I would take a little bit of risk there and choose a safer outcome, a likely to be a safer outcome to a landing on a 3,200 foot long grass strip. And don't forget, like towards Beach City, that's a rural area. There are more fields along there. So the likelihood that I could find another field like the one right below me seems pretty high.
Dave, you're not giving up the field. You are putting the airplane down right now, right here. Why?
Well, you know, for the reasons that you stated about, you know, the situation deteriorating way worse. You know, it's like maybe this is a stuck valve and the engine's, you know, we're just running on three cylinders. Maybe it's not. Maybe, as you say, this engine mount could give up and the airplane would be unflyable. And frankly, in general aviation, I don't think we do precautionary landings enough. I think that they could make some really bad situations less bad. And, you know, maybe this is something that's, maybe it is a stuck valve and you're able to replace the cylinder in the field. Who knows? You may even be able to fly it out of that field at some point. Yeah. But in general, I think pilots are too optimistic when we're confronted with an emergency situation. We always jump to the least bad thing that it could be. In this case, you know, a sticky valve. But if you make a precautionary landing now, I think what you're probably just dealing with one cylinder. If you fly it to an alternate, you may destroy the whole engine in the best case. You know, you may be circulating metal parts through that thing that's going to destroy it. And I'm just kind of reminded of my wife and I when we come to a parking lot. And it's like my inclination is to take the first acceptable parking space. And hers is to find the very best parking space. And so it's like in this situation, you know, the aviation gods have been kind. They've put a acceptable field right in front of you. I'm accepting the gift.
I like what you said about precautionary landings, too. We don't, you know, talk about them practice enough. But this is like precautionary landing squared. It's not just a precautionary landing. It's a precautionary off-field landing. And yet, Sarah, in Alaska, that's not such an uncommon thing, a precautionary off-field landing, right? Yet, you are going to the airport. You're going to Canton. So explain to me how you worked that out for yourself.
Yes, Alaska is kind of very unique because off-airport landings are pretty common, and a lot of people don't do them for mechanical. Some do, but a lot of it's done because of weather and other factors. That being said, I've had this exact scenario play out multiple times in my life, and I have actually done option one and I've done option four, both in my life. But the reasons that I used each of those were different based on the circumstances. One time I did have a valve failure, lost a cylinder in a Piper Archer, and I ended up limping the airplane because it was able to maintain altitude. The shaking wasn't too bad, and I was able to make it about 10 miles away to an airstrip. The other one was when I was practicing 8s on pylons and a Piper Aero, and I was low to the ground and applied power to come out of the maneuver, probably somewhere around 800 feet AGL, and that's when it happened, and I lost the cylinders, and I was not able to maintain altitude in that situation and picked an immediate field. I can't really tell from the scenario what exactly happened. You know, we're suspecting a valve failure, But in my experience, the engine has ran and the damage has been usually limited to the cylinder that it failed in my personal experience. And therefore, I think that option one would be the best in this scenario.
Yeah. John, you honestly put down option one. You, in the moment, you would keep going head to Canton. And then you said to yourself, wow, after listening to Richard, I'm not so sure anymore. What was it that swayed you?
Well, let me talk first about my initial decision to go straight ahead, because that's what I think we try to do as pilots, and we have the mindset of, you know, we can make it to an airport. Mm-hmm. And that's where I was going. It's right in front of me. I can probably see it at this point. So
yeah.
So my first inclination would be to go ahead. But in thinking about it, the option of turning back towards Beach City is actually a lot more enticing. It's roughly the same distance, but I've got a tailwind and better choices of landing in a field, you know, as we've all discussed. I think as pilots, we're very reluctant to put an airplane down in a precautionary landing in a field when the engine is still running. There's that psychological thing about giving up before the heroic pilot makes that last ditch effort. So whether it's for weather, you know, like Sarah was talking about, or any choice to put an airplane in a field with the engine still running is a really, really hard choice to make.
Yeah, so, there's a lot of fortitude there. And it's a good reason not yeah. to want to give up. And like, we, you know, we don't want to throw away altitude. We don't want to waste opportunities. But again, there's always the possibility of it going worse. Tom, you are heading to Beach City, but you really don't like it. You don't like any of these options.
Well, no, of course not.
No, of course not. But so tell me, like, what's going on for you in this position?
Well, I'm really tempted to try to put it down in the field underneath me also. But I think if I had the power going and I have the potential of other fields between where I am and Beach City, I would head toward Beach City. Strangely, I was thinking during the scenario that 80 knots is a little bit faster than VX speed. I might even try to trim the airplane and try to drift up a little bit en route just to give myself a little bit more altitude. But ultimately, I think I would have a better chance of getting my passenger and myself safely on the ground at a prepared airfield than a field that I've not been able to investigate at all, except it's a blotch of green that happens to be right there when this problem occurs.
Yeah, it's very theoretical. It's just sort of there on the Garmin. Sarah?
And seconding what Tom said about the field is that my experience from flying backcountry in Alaska and Idaho and all these places is that you really can't tell. There's been some places that I looked at to land that I was like, wow, this would be perfect. And then you get down low and it still looks good. And then you drag your wheels over it and you're like, oh no, this is no good. And that's for a Super Cub on 31-inch bush wheels. So it's really hard to tell and make that judgment call. And statistically speaking, airplanes, from an insurance standpoint, generally do sustain some level of damage. Usually not a whole lot of injuries, but airplanes do generally sustain damage when having forced off airport landings.
Wally, you're going to Beach City.
Yep.
Tell me about it.
And for some of the very reasons that Sarah has just made. I think there's just a lot of benefit in being able to put this airplane down at an approved airport. We know that an approved airport doesn't have power lines going across it. We've looked quickly at this field. We may or may not have seen all the power lines that are there. We have a saying in the glider world. We often land off field. And the saying is, just because you haven't seen any power lines doesn't mean they're not there. You just haven't found them yet.
Right.
And just keep looking, because you know that you have to know they're there. We know that that airport does likely not have a big ditch across the middle of it, which this field could have when we haven't seen yet. That kind of a ditch could put us on our back, perhaps.
Sure.
So I think there's just, you can eliminate a lot of risk by going to an approved airport. And I think in this scenario, it's clearly worth doing that, because you have field options along the way, and especially since you can maintain altitude.
Dave.
Yeah, you know, I think your chances of actually spotting the wires in a shaking, vibrating airplane are extremely low. You know, so yeah. But still, I'm going to the precautionary landing in the field. And I've actually done that once. It was a cylinder failure, but it was a it wasn't a stuck valve. It was the cylinder broke around the barrel. And so, you know, in addition to losing the cylinder, one cylinder in a four-cylinder airplane, there was also some oil on the windshield, some smoke in the cockpit. You know, it was more than just the shaking, but the shaking was violent. I mean, you could not read the panel. It was, you know, it was not a trivial event.
And you also had a failure, I think it was in a Dauntless, where you had to make this kind of decision about not going over a populated area.
Right.
Just in a nutshell, what happened?
Well, the plane made the decision for me because I was having the debate. It was in DeLand, Florida, and I was having the debate of, do I fly across the town or not? I mean, the airport's 5 miles away. I can see it. I'm aligned with the runway. You know, I'm sort of fixated on the airport as the destination. And then the engine quit entirely. So it you know, it was in it, and when it happened, I was like, good, decision made. You know? now we're gonna land in this little grass glider strip instead. So I could just focus on that option then.
Yeah, so that was kind of a blessing. Sarah.
And seconding what Dave said, I've had a similar experience. And in my scenario, I had to choose between landing on I-10 or taking the aircraft across a little bit of water to the other strip. And I was maintaining altitude and the engine ran the entire time. And it was rough. It was definitely violent, but it wasn't violent to the point that I would have suspected that the engine mounts would have gave way.
Tom.
I had a cylinder, fuel injector come out of a cylinder in a six-cylinder engine, and you lose much more than 1/6 of your power when that happens. Mm-hmm. So I have reasonably relevant experience. But I think a big part of my reluctance to go to the field that's underneath me is the fact that I don't have the backcountry off-airport landing experience that Sarah and Dave and maybe Richard have. This would have been, on top of everything else, the very first time that I landed off airport. And given that I have some power available, I'm going to try to get to the airport if I can.
Yeah, and that's a great point in terms of this pilot is almost certainly has never had that experience of landing off airport. And we talk about in an emergency situation, trying to normalize, right? You want to bring as many things into your normal pattern and flow as you can so that they are sort of automatic and remove as many differential variables as you can. John.
I'm glad you used the E word because I wanted to talk about that,
yeah.
About the interaction with ATC that you would have in this. Presumably, we didn't say it in the setup, but presumably you're already talking to Akron Approach because you're approaching a Class C. So the very first thing you want to do is declare an emergency, obviously, to utilize whatever assistance you can get, because it truly is an emergency. Mm-hmm. And ATC has a lot of resources that they can help you with. If you decide that you're going to Beach City and you tell them that, they can alert the locals to get the CFR, whatever they have out there. Local fire trucks, ambulances, and stuff like that. But I will say that ATC is probably going to try and talk you into going to Akron or to Canton. They're kind of spring-loaded to that, towards going towards a paved, larger airport. On the video map, the Akron, or Canton rather, you know, is going to be their center, the focal point. The video map shows very similar to what the sectional does. Beach City is just going to be able to circle with no services. And the mindset's going to be kind of to bypass that and try and get you to a real airport. So as PIC, you may have to tell them, no, I don't want to do that. You're going to have to take authority and take control and say, no, I'm going towards Beach City. And they may even try to continue to vector you towards the other airport. But a feature that at least most terminal ATCs have is, much like our GPS, a nearest airport finder. And it's filterable. It's a keyboard entry. So you can select like level 1, 2, or 3. Level 1 would be any airport. 2 is hard surfaced more than 4,000. And controller very possibly could do that. But they're going to want to hit the hard surfaced airport and try to direct you towards that. So you really may need to exercise your authority. And The other thing would be tell them to shut up, because the first thing that they're going to do is give me the souls and fuel and all this stuff, and just tell them, shut up. I got some flying stuff to do here, so take control. So,
some great tips in there, Dave.
I think that's so true that it's like John's point. The controller is going to say, you're going to say emergency. They're going to say Canton Airport, 10 miles straight ahead, cleared to land any runway. Yeah. And that just, they can't see that there's a big green open flat field in front of you. And
right.
and that's going to have to be your call.
Sarah.
Well, one thing to think about too here is that sometimes grass strips can be really hard to find. I know that, you know, in Houston, whenever I'm doing practical exams and we do the VFR cross country portion, a lot of the applicants will use some of our local grass strips as landmarks and waypoints. I'll literally see the airport that they put down there, and I'm thinking to myself, you're not going to see it. And they never do. If you're not familiar with it, it might be really hard to pick out that grass strip. And the worst thing that you can do for yourself is to take the risk, fly all the way down there, and then circle overhead while you're trying to find it.
Tom.
Well, to that point, one of the things I would do en route, I wouldn't be circling over this field I'm over to have the other pilot find the iPad. But while I'm on the way, that's something I thought about, is dig out the iPad and help me find this airport over here. I wanted to come back to John was talking about, and Dave a little bit about the interaction with air traffic control. I've spoken with a lot of, with a particular controller who's working on some ideas for helping controllers interact with pilots. And my attitude is, when it comes to information, controllers provide and pilots decide. And a corollary to that is, don't ask the controller what to do. Tell them what you want to do and what information you need to be able to do it. And so we as pilots need to keep ourselves in that mindset. So whether you decide to land on the field here or go to Beach City or go on to Canton, tell the controller what you want to do, which is really what John was saying.
Right, and to back that up, you don't need the iPad that's under the seat. The controller can tell you the field elevation, the runway alignment, the frequency, you know, all that stuff is readily available.
Yeah, if you say, I'm going to Beach City, then that tells them what button to push. Yeah,
okay. Right, and provide all the information that you need.
How much, staying with you for a second, John, how much can they actually help you at the end of this? Picking up on Sarah's point, grass fields are hard to find, and usually it's you see the airplanes, you know, if yeah. you're not familiar with, oh, there's some hangars, there's some airplanes, so that's the airport right there. But this is an airplane that's shaking, your adrenaline is up, like this is going to be difficult to find. How much can the controller help at the end of that process?
I think it vector you right towards it pretty accurately, but probably no more accurately than you can do yourself with a GPS on board. And then there's always the issue of they want to vector you right to the airport, which might not put you in a good position to find a runway and to land. Coming from the northeast like that with a, I think it's a 10-2-8 at this, you're probably going to be at a weird angle to see the runway. And I think Richard said in his thing, he would offset a little bit to set himself up for either some sort of traffic pattern entry. So they're not going to know to do that. They're going to head you right for the little circle on the map.
Wally.
We talk about sticking valves or rough engine here, and there's a whole variety of intensities of that. I've had sticking valves, which causes a little bit of roughness occasionally. I've had a valve stick, which takes a cylinder out of the equation. And I've broken a connecting rod, which is clearly so rough that I was, in that case, clearly worried about the engine coming off the mounts. And the only way to stop the vibration was to reduce the power to zero, pull the propeller control to low RPM, and at 300 RPM, the shaking was satisfactory. I no longer was worried about losing the engine off the airplane. But so it's all relative. And I guess, you know, we're talking about, should we land in the field? Should we go onto the airport? And none of us are feeling that shaking today. I've also found in occasion with sticking valves that they'll be intermittent, because mm-hmm. the temperature in the engine is going to change as you either add power, reduce power, or slow down in this scenario. And sometimes that temperature change is enough to free up that valve for a little while. So So sticking valves, I think, is really worthwhile trying to stick with it, if you will, because sorry for the pun, but it may take you a little farther than you thought you could go.
You know, Tom, you brought up a great point about losing a sixth or a quarter of, you know, the engine displacement, if you will, is not a sixth or a quarter of the power. And it's sort of like when you become a multi-engine pilot for the first time and you learn like, oh, I lost 50%. I lost one engine and you lost 85% of your climb because it had to do with how much excess you have. So it's shocking the first time how much power you lose with one bad cylinder out of four or six. It sounds like every one of us around this table has had either a complete failure or a partial failure or both. So I'm going to say that, you know, you fly long enough, you're going to run into one of those two things. We've talked about this a little before, but it seems so appropriate here. Partial power failures, it's not something we practice, but it seems like the easiest thing in the world to simulate, right? So what should a pilot do? What's the right way to think about this? Because it's probably even more likely than the complete power failure that every BFR, power to idle, where are you going? Sarah.
It's interesting that you bring that up. And I actually know multiple other DPEs in the Houston area that specifically provide the scenario with a partial power failure as part of the check ride. And it is something, you know, it is listed there in the ACS, partial and complete power plant failures. And so it's something that should be taught, and there are some DPEs that choose to evaluate that specific scenario.
Tom?
There's actually a very interesting paper that was done by the Australian Transport Safety Bureau in 2010, and it discusses specifically that the rate of partial power loss in reportable engine failure accidents. And what they found in Australia was that partial loss of power resulting in a mishap report was about three times as likely as total power failure. They even have something in there, and they have a beautifully Australian term, the matrix of uncertainty or something like that. But what that gets at is that if you have a total loss of power, as Dave had in the case he was talking about earlier, you know what you need to do. You've got to put it down there somewhere. If you have just a little tiny bit of a loss of power, you may not notice it too much. You just go to the next airport. You might go on to Canton in this case. It's where you have somewhere in the, you know, 40 to 60% power loss that you're really tempted to try things that might not work out really well. Back to your other point, when I did lose that one cylinder in the Bonanza that time, I found just completely by accident, I hadn't really thought about it up to that point, but I found that I could hold 4,000 feet at full throttle, full prop, mixture almost fully rich, if I maintained best glide speed. And if I went 5 knots faster, I was going down at 500 or 600 foot per minute. If I went 5 knots slower, I was going down. So we talk about best glide as a speed to fly in the event of a total engine failure, but actually it will get you the maximum performance for whatever power you have remaining. And it might be that in this scenario here, that if you aimed for not VX, as I suggested earlier, but if you aimed for best glide speed, you might be able to stay aloft longer or actually gain some altitude to have more options to work with.
So it's sort of like that coffin corner, yeah. You know, where yeah. Airplanes get up by altitude. Basically, you've reduced your power to the point where you're stuck.
Yeah,
in that's a great theoretical point. But when the panel is shaking and you can't read the airspeed indicator, it's not easy to do.
But you have a great tip about, you know, best glide, can't read your airspeed. Forget about your airspeed indicator. There's an easier way.
Yeah, just fly level. Just have the chord of the wing level with the horizon, and that will get you close.
Yeah, certainly close enough. Yeah. I want to go back around to you, Richard. Approaching Beach City, so it's a crosswind that you're going to have to deal with there for sure, but it's 115 feet wide, which is kind of nice, the grass runway. Unfortunately, it's also only 3,000 feet long. Right. So you have this kind of unusual layout and illusion to deal with. I'd like you to address that. And I'd also, and it might be at the same time here, like to walk us through the process that you talked about in the ER, like how you're actually going to approach this airport, and then walk us through the pattern, quote unquote, that you're going to fly all the way to the wheels on the ground that's giving you the most likelihood of success.
Yeah, sure. It's one of the things in GA that I don't think we teach that well, and that is what in the military we called an SFO, or a simulated flameout pattern, right? Where if you simulate you're losing an engine, the whole goal is to try to fly overhead a field or a place where you're going to land and make it from that point standard. So you fly overhead the field. In this case, in GA, 1,000 foot's a standard pattern. If you fly overhead the field aligned with the runway, so you're flying straight down the runway at pattern altitude, you've got the runway made now. You can set yourself up for standard parameters so you know how to manipulate your airplane based on winds and whatever thrust you may or may not have to come down to a landing. So in this case, I'd fly overhead the field. The winds are coming from the north, so I'd make my turn to the right. So I'd make it a right pattern instead of a left because I want to turn into that headwind. I don't want to risk turning away from it and getting too far away from the field, and now I can't glide back, right, if I lose the engine. So I'd make my turn into there, and now it's just a constant, steady descent where halfway through the base turn, I should be at about 500 AGL. And by the way, this is the way that you pretty much fly a pattern in a Super Cub or a 172 anyway. Once you get a beam the numbers and you're ready to turn, you pretty much put the throttle in idle anyway, and you just, you know, fly your pattern from there. So from there, you're at 500, halfway through base turn, you ought to be about 500 feet. I'd aim to be 1,000 feet down on this 3,000-foot grass strip or 3,200 feet. And the reason is most pilots, and I might be susceptible to that, when you have an engine out or when you probably do, I know you do this a lot, Sarah, pulling engines on people. When I instruct it, most of the time they come up short. Very few times do they actually go too long. So I'm going to hedge that a little bit and realize that if I land 1,000 feet down, if I'm short, I got a lot of room. And even if I'm long, I still have a lot of room. It's a 172. I ought to be able to put that thing down in 1,000 feet, you know, from the time I hit the grass. So that's essentially the technique for a simulated flameout pattern.
And the landing short versus landing long, certainly, if you come up short and that's an error, you've still got a lot of kinetic energy because that was the early part of the landing. Landing long, worst case scenario, you're rolling off the end of the field, maybe 30 miles an hour, and crashing through some things.
Yeah, and let me just add to that, you've also got, you know, your ability to slip the airplane to lose altitude, so you got that. And then as a final result, changing your configuration, which in this case is, now you're pretty sure you've got the airfield made, now I'm just manipulating flaps for partial or full or whatever I need to get the drag ratio right and land where I want to.
Wally, you've taught a lot of off-field landings with the glider pilots and your glider days. Things to add to that?
No, I think, you know, just as Richard said, try to make the pattern look as normal as you can. If I was in a 172, I would, instead of, I understand turning into the wind, your thought, but in the left seat, I don't want my back to be to that field. I want to be able to watch that field. So I would have made a left pattern and just tried to make sure I compensated for the wind. Because you're going to hit lift and sink as you're coming around there. And as you do that, you need to see that runway and how you're doing so you can either adjust by tightening your pattern or stretching it out or changing configuration, as you said. So,
Dave.
And this isn't necessarily a power-off situation. The engine is still running. But if it were an actual power-off, to Richard's point, everybody ends up short, and I would aim for the middle. I think, you know, the guidance, standard guidance is to aim for the first third, and the first third to me is not far enough down the runway.
Wally, looks like you have something to say there.
Well, I have a question for Sarah.
Oh, go ahead.
Now, both of you have said this norm is to come up short. Sarah, in your experience doing flight tests, do they normally come up short?
I would probably say it's about 50-50. Between going too long, and a lot of times when people go too long, they'll try to change the field at the last minute.
Right, exactly.
You know, I've found that quite a bit. They don't commit. You know, they realize, oh no, I'm going to be short or I'm going to be long, and then they change their mind, and it ends up becoming kind of a disaster after that.
That's the more common thing I saw in doing practical tests as well. They are so worried about coming up short that they way overcompensate, and about the time they're on base leg and they recognize they're way too high, they say, oh, I'm going to go to this field over here now, which, you know.
How does that work out for them, Wally?
Well, typically not very well.
Yeah.
it works out, in the long run, it works out good because they get an opportunity to get some more training in it. And they
get a lovely pink slip to go on the wall there.
Yeah, but in the end, they're better pilots for it. You know?
Fair enough. But that's an interesting point about that, like making a change of decision, like at the last moment and how decisions play in here. And it brings me back to another question. This pilot experience the problem. There's the airport. To their credit, they had the fortitude not to immediately be like, just beelined to the airport there. They looked around for, you know, can I make it and some other options. And then the friend, like, tossed in this extra option that just kind of complicated matters. And yet that was the majority of the decisions here, was to actually go that way. What do you think? Was that helpful? Was that not helpful? To your point, Richard, you had good options and then it got complicated by somebody. And it could have been complicated worse by ATC. Sarah?
Well, I think that in any situation, regardless of the available options, you should evaluate all of them and say, okay, based on the current circumstances, exactly what's going on now, what is the best course of action? If you have another pilot with you in the aircraft, say, hey, what do you think? You know, maybe talk to ATC. I mean, what do you think? ATC might say, oh, wow, you know, actually that airport's been closed for years. You know, it's been overgrown. I mean, use all your available resources before making that final decision.
That makes a lot of sense to me. And I think one of the things that sort of stuck for me in my mind here is what you said, Richard, about, you know, not making the perfect the enemy of the good. If this was, say, a stuck valve situation, you almost certainly would have made Canton. There's just a couple minutes of danger there, but there could have been somebody on the ground. You certainly could have made the field, but you could have rolled over there. There's landing on the road, which we didn't really have an opportunity to talk about, and there are issues around that. Oh, wait, a co-pilot has another option here. Or you could grab the iPad, or you could ask ATC. You don't have time for that when this all happens for real, which is why we're all here talking and why people are listening. So the takeaway here is don't stop thinking about this here at Canton and this scenario. You want to think about where the red zones are for all the flights that you regularly do, chair flying while you got time sitting at a stoplight or whatever it is, and about the longer flights you're going to do to places you've never been before. Where are the red zones? Where is the danger? And what might I do there? So you won't have to waste time or lose opportunities when it actually happens.